Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org. We're delighted to have Farah Pandis with us today to discuss the policy implications of the recent White House summit on countering violent extremism. Farah Pandis is Adjunct Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and served as the first ever special representative to Muslim communities under former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She is currently a part of the leadership team at the Counter Extremism Project and a strategic advisor at the Risk Assistance Network and Exchange. She has held a number of senior positions over the last decade, including political appointments in three administrations. While serving as special representative, she launched numerous youth-focused initiatives, including Generation Change, Viral Peace, the Transatlantic Leadership Network, and Hours Against Hate. Welcome, Farah. Thank you very much for being with us today. It's great to have you with us, and great to have you on board at the Council on Foreign Relations. You were at the last month's White House Summit on Countering Violent Extremism. You spoke there. It would be great if you could start us off by talking about the summit and what you took away from it. Why was it important?
Yeah, no, thank you. And I want to thank Council for hosting this call. I think it's important that we have a conversation about not just, you know, what the aftermath of the summit, but the importance of it. As we think about the summit, I think I would say a couple of things. One is, I think it's really important that President Obama put together a three-day opportunity for not just our country, but countries around the world to gather together to talk about the ideology of the extremists. It's a growing threat, obviously, that is just getting more and more pervasive in the weeks and months that we have been watching the growth of ISIS and other ideologies over the course of the many years since 9/11. But in the context of ISIS, particularly, the last 2 years has demonstrated some very particular, very alarming trends in terms of the numbers of people who are joining both their actual armies and their virtual armies. So I think it's really important that President Obama talked about the ideological threat. And I think I'd say, you know, importantly, it's demonstrating the ability for America to put this on the, put this front and center, that there is an ideological war. You know, you will recall that President Obama engaged with Muslims right off the bat in his administration, both in the inaugural address that he gave when he became president, and in Turkey a few months later, but obviously the historic Cairo speech of 2006. And I think that, you know, what you're seeing in the trajectory of the years since he's become president, in the Cairo speech, you know, the word ideology or terror was never used, okay? And if you look at his two speeches over the course of the White House summit, you know, both of those terms were used nearly 75 times. I mean, that is a great change in the way in which this president is thinking about the threat, how he's talking about it. So it's demonstrating a leadership on his behalf, and also, you know, his you know, attention and focus on the ideological part. But then I would also say that it was really important that President Obama talked about both violent and nonviolent ideologies that are building and are part of the ecosystem that are moving the minds of millennials. And I think that that is really important. So as we talk about the ideological threat, as we think about it, we see leadership from the United States government. We see a growing cohesion building among the different nation states that came to the summit to take part in the ideological conversation. And finally, the importance of soft power. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we continue the conversation today. But the idea here, of course, is that the only tools in the toolbox to fight the ideology of the extremist is not just hard power. It's the so-called soft power pieces that we need to actually see. So when I think about the importance of the summit, both the domestic conversation that we had and the international conversation we had, we saw the president put on the table a new way of thinking about this threat. But I also will say, as somebody who took part in the day at the White House when we were, it was really more of a domestic day, but really showcasing something really important. And what you heard from many people during that summit is that this threat is, this is not just a domestic issue. This is not just, you know, something that we can be thinking about in terms of protecting our nation, but this is obviously a global issue that's connected among millennials. But the other piece here is, who's going to stop the ideology from spreading? And some of the most compelling pieces of the summit were the conversations by speakers talking about the need for non-government actors to take part in this conversation and to really scale up efforts at the civil society level that can push back against the ideology of the extremists. So, for example, you heard both the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, Google Ideas, and Gen Next Foundation give very compelling presentations about what the work that they're doing, why the private sector is important in this, what they can add value with. You heard about particular campaigns that were happening online and offline. You heard from the community members talking about nascent ideas that they have to push back. And I think all of this goes to sketch out a illustration of where we are today in 2015, where government is saying not only is there an ideological piece here, but that we understand that we are not, the buck doesn't stop just with us. It has to be far more than that. And I will say, as somebody who served in both the Bush administration and in the Obama administration working on CVE, that indeed the lessons that were learned right after 9/11 in terms of pushing back against the ideology of the extremists, that credible voices matter, that things have to happen at the local level. You're seeing build out in earnest with this particular summit, lessons that have come from years before that have built and really been articulated in a very clear way through the illustration of the summit. So I thought it was important that he did this. The question now becomes, of course, what happens next?
And what do you think will happen next? What will be the lasting effect of the summit? Will there be another one convened? What are the next steps?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I don't know that there's any plan at all to have the next summit. I think that we can get it ourselves into paralysis, summit paralysis, when we see this kind of thing year after year. People are just having conversations. I think the time has come for action. And what I really hope this will catalyze is a robust mobilization of the ideas that we have heard that work and that need to happen, that you're going to find the opportunity for new partnerships to be built of like-minded thinkers that can be provoked and monopolized globally, so that we are fighting the extremist ideology. We're not letting them win, which they're doing right now. That we have the capacity to be able to push back in a faster way. The success of all of this will be indeed if governments that came to the summit, along with civil society groups, are working in partnership to push back against the ideology by scaling up efforts that already exist.
Great. As you look ahead or look at the growing threat of countering extremism, and 2015 has been a pretty tumultuous already, and we're only in the third month of it, do you see it getting better, or is it likely to get worse?
Right. So, you know, this has been a particularly shocking beginning to our year, both the beheadings, the cruel and unreal images that we've seen on our screens, the narratives of the extremists, the increase of foreign fighters, the appalling nature of the seduction of teenagers who are going over for all kinds of reasons. the outrageous, efforts on behalf of the extremists in terms of what they're doing to minorities and what they are, what they've done to human history with the decimation of historic sites. I mean, all of this the last couple of months has just been beyond devastating. And I will tell you that what they are doing and what they are practicing in what their actions we can imagine something even worse than is happening right now unless we see a new kind of mobilization that goes forward by civil society to be able to aggressively push back against the ideology. I mean, this is really about inoculating communities from that ideology and really doing more than we have ever done before to fight this ideological war. And there is no sign, I said to you earlier that this is not just about the actual armies. It's also about the virtual armies. And what we've seen is lone wolf type events also that are being provocative and scary on the world stage. That too adds to the instability and the global threat. So when I look ahead out there, I can, in fact, and so can I'm sure most of the listeners today, think through the devastating scenarios that could take place if there's no counter to the ideology, if there's no real robust effort to push back and to stem this. And the only way that's going to happen is if we align forces on the soft power space and combine the strategy of both soft and hard power to make this happen. I'll end by simply saying I do believe that the war of ideas is winnable. I think it is possible to stem the vast majority of recruits, and I believe that the solutions are available, and I believe that they are affordable. The questions we need to be asking ourselves is why are we not scaling them up? Why are we not doing more? And can we invest in the 24/7 machinery that is required for the soft power effort? So that we're seeing efforts by in every part of the world that are moving. Moving to build and inoculate communities.
And one final thing, and then we'll open it up. This is a call for religious leaders and scholars. What can this community be doing to help counter violent extremism?
Right. So, I mean, I think we've seen since 9/11 the religious communities globally speak out, work together, build coalitions, partner in a lot of different ways. But the efforts have been very small. Not to say that they're not important. They have been important and symbolic in some senses, also historic and symbolic. But it can't be a ad hoc effort. It cannot just be uneven. It needs to be. We need to be at the pace and at the scale that the bad guys are, and that means that religious leaders and scholars must find new mechanisms to consistently push out what needs to be done in a way that millennials can absorb the information that they're putting forward. Debunking the narrative of the extremists from the theological point of view is important, and religious scholars obviously can do that. Also, the kind of coalitions that can be built at an education level are really important, but it cannot be. I think that the cry needs to come from not just, small programs that are affecting 20 people in a school, but how do you build this out so it is a massive program that we're enveloping communities with so that they're building the kind of resilience that are needed.
Thank you very much. This is a terrific overview. Let's open it up now to the group.
Thank you, ma'am. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Again, we are now holding. Please press star 1 if you would like to ask a question. Our first question will come from John Chan from the Episcopal Church.
Yeah, Farah, I'm glad you're engaged in this conversation, and I know that we've met in the past when I was in Washington, and you were working for the State Department and others in the two administrations. You served well. I'm very distressed by the way in which President Obama continues to be vilified for not addressing this violence as Islamic violence, and the push to have him make that kind of connection. I along with Cardinal McCarrick, spent 4 days in Tehran over mid part of December at a conference that some would vilify, but it brought together 48 members of different governments, primarily foreign ministers and ambassadors, to discuss the whole issue of Daesh. And an effort to really begin to build coalitions to address the issue that you're addressing today. So the question is, you know, how do you feel about the way in which the president has been vilified for not addressing this violence as being Islamic in nature, number one? And number two, in order to build coalitions, sometimes, as Nick Burns used to say, you have to get into the tent with others you may have some serious disagreements with, but who have very common elements of concern that can be worked on. And I think that that's really where we have to be, but I would leave that up to you.
Well, first of all, it's nice to hear your voice, and it's been a long time, I have a smile on my face. You can't see me, so thank you for the question. It's great to be back in touch with you. So I think you're asking a really important the first question about sort of lexicon, and I think it's been a really interesting and quite exasperating conversation that we've seen happen globally around the terminology in many different capacities, not just with what President Obama is saying, but how we're talking about particular non-state actors and what they call themselves, and you know we've all been watching this very carefully. Let us remember, I'm taking sort of the larger 80,000-foot view. I think as I look at American presidents and I look at the way every single one of our presidents, starting with George Washington all the way to our current president, has spoken about the religion of Islam, you can go back and look at the words of our presidents. They have used dignity. They have used very compelling and very gracious and dignified and honorable language around religion and people of all faiths and who we are as Americans. And that's the most important principle here. Our commanders-in-chief, our presidents of the United States, have a role that they must play in terms of welcoming everybody, and I think it's important. Secondly, I will say to you, if you look at Carter, if you look at Reagan, if you look at President George W. Bush, whether it was the Iran hostage issue, whether it was most 9/11, whether it's President Obama now with this particular crisis, all of the presidents have had to navigate through the lexicon question. What are we calling this? These are non-state actors, organizations that are using and manipulating aspects that they believe are religious to seduce people in a particular direction. And our presidents have chosen various ways of talking about it. You will remember that President George W. Bush in 2005 gave a speech in which he said, some people call it this, some people call it this, some people call it this, whatever you're going to call it. That's how he handled it because it is a radioactive issue when you start connecting religion with, you know, an ideology that's being used by extremists. And so it's a long way of saying to you that I think that President Obama has been very clear about why it is that he is choosing to do what he is doing and how he's describing it. And whether people like it or not, that is what he is doing. And I think we need to move beyond. He is being respectful. That is what he's decided to do. This is how he wants to do it. And by the way, as you are aware as well, scholars themselves do not have a perfect definition of what it is ISIL or Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram or Al-Shabaab or any of these crazy groups are what it is that they're exactly trying to do and how they're trying to describe it. Is it you know, is it Islamist? Is it Islamic? Is it, you know, I mean, we've heard this conversation. We need to focus on pushing back against the ideology of these groups that are preying upon. And this is where I think we need to be clear. The issue is about these groups that are trying to recruit from a very specific demographic. And that demographic is not a demographic of people who happen to be culturally or religiously affiliated with Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, or any other faith. The bad guys are focused on young people who have an affinity toward, because of cultural or historic or familial reasons, the religion of Islam. And I only say that because I think we need to understand that the group that is at risk right now from the threat of these particular extremists are Muslim millennials. And that's as far as I will, I mean, I think that we've got to be very clear and go as far as we can in that conversation to understand who is at risk right now. This conversation that we've had about debating about what the president should or should not say, I think, takes away from the larger thing. He is doing what every president before him has done in terms of how they've tried to be respectful of Islam, and I think we need to understand that in the larger context. In your second question, you asked about coalitions and who goes into a tent. In this particular issue of countering violent extremism and pushing back against the ideology of the extremists, we are seeing the kind of coalitions and this is not a political conversation. This is like, I'm talking about credible voices. The kind of coalitions that have been built are different kinds of actors. You're seeing artists and theologians and scholars and others who have credibility with youth to be able to push back against that ideology. And I think that that's a very powerful thing that we have to do. I think we get into a lot of trouble when we start dissecting into the political aspects of all of this only. And I think that becomes very dangerous because it isn't just the political arm of this. If you're talking to millennials about the threat that they're facing, and you're talking to communities about how this foreign ideology is coming in, it isn't about the politics. It is about a pull on an identity crisis that these Muslim millennials are having and them getting answers from the extremists that fit a particular thing, which is why the kind of coalitions that we need to build to push back against that ideology need to be robust, and they need to be very innovative and creative, not just the same kind of people that have come to the table before. And I think that this kind of out-of-the-box thinking hasn't been done enough, frankly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Bruce Knott of the United Nations office.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. My question is, I believe Islam, like all religions, has kind of had a dialogue, a tension between, liberals and progressives, and I think that balance has been thrown out of whack recently, primarily because of oil money, and because of money coming from states that are religiously conservative and sometimes radical and violent. And it means that progressives don't have access to money and to broadcast a medium that allow them to get their message across. And I think what the U.S. government has to try to do in a way that doesn't kind of, say that this is being funded by the U.S. government, but we need to bolster those parts of Islam that are moderate, that are progressive, that would naturally be bolstered in a more equitable kind of global situation where oil money isn't propping up one side to the detriment of others. And how are there ways, is the administration thinking of ways that we can provide resources to moderate and progressive Islamic voices?
So thanks for the question. This issue of bolstering moderate, in your words, moderate Muslims, I think that this is something that this is what I was sort of hitting at when Irina was asking me these questions. The way in which you can defeat the narrative of the extremists is when you are able to fill the marketplace with counter narratives to the narratives of the extremists in a wide range of ways, with what we call credible voices. And those kinds of voices, are grassroots, and they are very localized. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not, something that's going to be working in one neighborhood will work in another. And so it takes time to understand who those voices are and who will work for those particular kids in that particular neighborhood. So to answer your question, one of the things that we absolutely learned in the post-Danish cartoon crisis, in the pilot and the experimentation we were doing in Europe, is that the greatest strength of the United States government was to be the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with the ideas that we heard on the ground. And in the context of the post, 2007 to 2009, I was working on this actually firsthand. We were going around, and listening to what communities across Europe that were Muslim were saying about what they thought was needed to push back. And in some cases, we gave them help in terms of small seed money to actually scale up their ideas. In other places, we connected voices that had not known each other, so that they were building networks of like-minded thinkers. And in other places, we were helping some of those grassroots organizations didn't want any U.S. government money, but they wanted to get some skills to learn how to do things better. And so we were doing that, and we were beginning to scale up and piloting a lot of the programs that are actually, some of them are still vibrant and aware right now. But it wasn't about bringing it to people with the United States flag all over it. And by the way, everything was absolutely transparent. This is not some like black world stuff. This was very clear, transparent, open world, white world initiatives that we were doing. But it was listening to what was happening at the grassroots to understand what it is that they're needed, that were needed. And so I say this to you because in the Obama administration, we were doing that too. We learned, and the work that I did as special representative was building the voices of young Muslims. And one of the initiatives that I feel most proud about is something called Generation Change, which is a generation of young Muslims under the age of 30 all over the world who wanted to take part in their communities and do more. We built 30 chapters of Generation Change all over the world, from the Philippines to Ireland to Brazil to, Malaysia. We have 500 or more of these members of Generation Change that are young people who are active and change makers. And that's the kind of stuff the United States government can do. It can use its power to build the kinds of coalitions and connect voices, build the platform so that their voices can be pushed forward in a real way. The second piece of this, sir, that you asked in terms of money coming from specific countries to push forward a very conservative form of life, vis-a-vis religion, I think the United States government, and by the way, every other government in the world too, needs to be very clear, very honest, very direct about what is taking place in their communities. And if foreign money is coming in to change the way people think about who they are, we need to talk about it. If mosques that have been around for 1,000 years are being decimated to build brand new shiny mosques that have a very particular kind of brand of how you live your life, we need to talk about it. If there is a program that, which by the way is happening around the world, if people are going in and decimating historic memory so that within one generation people don't understand the diversity of religion in that particular place, or even the diversity of Islam in that particular place, why aren't we talking about it? And what we have been doing very well is a little dance over the course of the last 15 years in the conversation about what may or may not be happening. Heads up, folks, things are happening. And the ecosystem in which we're living is breeding an us-and-them mentality. We need to talk about the infiltration of external ideologies that promote anti-Semitism. We must talk about the decimation of the idea that people can live side by side and have for you know, hundreds of years, but yet now a new ideology is coming in saying that you can't do this anymore. And the eradication of the diversity of thought and the idea of lineage and historic memory, all of these things are combined to create ecosystems that are changing. And that's happening on our planet right now. So with the trillions of dollars of foreign money that's being used around the world, all of us, it is incumbent upon all of us, including governments, to speak about it, talk about it, and call it out.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Margaret Rose of the Episcopal Church. Ms. Rose, your line is now open. Please make sure your phone is not on mute.
Great, thank you. I wanted to follow up on your comment about the effort from religious groups seeming too small. And while I think that is definitely true, we are not large enough, I think the media don't pick up that, pick up what is there. I know that there are a couple of articles in the Times last week that had to do with some work that Muslim clerics here in the U.S. and also in England were involved in. So I'm asking you first about the role of the media in all of this. And secondly, we didn't really talk specifically about this. I'd like to hear sort of how you think women's voices might engage in this work in ways that might be different from what's out there. Or
so
are
thank
the
you
women's
for-
there may be the question.
So thanks very, very much for both of those really important questions. The first on the role of media, I don't even know how to say this. It boggles my mind that in 2015, we are still not seeing the kind of efforts by all of us to help each other tell stories. So I say that to you because it's not just sort of the news, who's reporting on the news, what's news. We don't have to have a long conversation about the field of journalism and media right now and how people pick stories. It's more of the storytellers, how they get out, what they do, both in film and in other ways. I think the larger issue here in terms of how we promote and how we understand the efforts that are taking place, and I would agree with you. I mean, I think that more could be done, more efforts. Everything is sort of a one-off. You see the story, it goes away, it's out of somebody's mind. They'll say, oh, you know, 2 or 3 months ago, I remember reading something in such and such magazine, or there was a story on whatever show, and they promoted this kind of thing. But there's no news channel that, you know, devoted to hearing the stories that will make us happy or give us hope. So we have an uphill battle in terms of trying to get out what's taking place and make it more available to the average citizen so that they can see that good work is being done and in fact, perhaps be inspired by it to do more, not only to give money towards those efforts, but also to help in those efforts. I don't really have an answer for you in terms of why people are doing anything. You know, it's interesting. I got a call from a major media outlet the other day who said to me, I've been doing my homework, and I heard about this program called Viral Peace that you started when you were special representative. And I kind of thought to myself, awesome that they know about this now, and I'm glad that they understand that we were trying to get young people to push back online against extremists, and this was seeded, you know, in 2010 and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, the traction that we need at times is right when it begins to go out the door, you know, and I don't know what to say except to say that we have to, the gentleman who asked the question much earlier about coalitions, some of that coalition stuff has got to be all of us working to make sure that we are cross-pollinating to people that we know the stories that we hear, and that's part of the work that we all have to do together. And I'm not being Pollyanna when I say this, but really to understand that actually helps. If enough producers hear, my God, you need to hear from John Doe, or you need to go do that. You know, that's how those stories get told. So we need to do more of that. Your second point, your second question, really, really important. The role of women's voices, and I think you know, at a time when much of the world is surprised to see females getting radicalized and joining ISIS, are surprised by all of that. You know, we're looking at that dimension of women and extremism. But there are two pieces to this. One is there are voices on the side of like women, in fact, being moved in a direction that becomes more extreme, so that they end up either going to Syria or moving in that direction and becoming more closed and interpret this us and them ideology a very particular way. The danger, obviously, in that is not even just them leaving, but it's also because a mother is a child's first teacher. If a mother is moving mentally in a direction that creates that us and them, she is raising her children to be that way as well. And so what we have to do is not only understand the phenomenon that is taking place with women who are becoming more and more radicalized, because it's a growing phenomenon, but understanding the narratives that the bad guys are using specifically for women, so that we know how to counter that particular messaging. And I, you know, I wrote a piece in The Guardian. I mean, I think women understand women can be the power tool here to get behind the counter narratives that will work for women. We have not spent enough time on that at all, and we need to do far more of it because it's a growing threat. You're seeing the kids, the girls from the UK, you're seeing the three girls from Denver, and many, many other examples of women who are now moving in that way, and what's happening with the armies of women of ISIS and what they're doing and how they're changing the game for many. But then there's the other piece completely, which is the power of women within a community to build resilience and to help inoculate those communities. Women are often see things before others do. They're the canary in the coal mine. And what we have to be able to do is to build the kind of platforms that women can actually speak out and have a structure from which they're able to talk about this. One of the initiatives that was seeded in the Bush administration that it's not at all connected to government at all right now, but it was because we understood the power of female voices, is called Sisters Against Violent Extremism, SAVE, SAVE. The SAVE network was started and modeled after Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but we were using women to push forward, to push against, obviously, the extremist ideology, but push forward an idea that they can build resilience. And the person who we partnered with is a woman named Dr. Edith Schaffler, who runs an NGO in Vienna and took on Sisters Against Violent Extremism. It's hers now. She's run it for many years. She's the person. Raised money from outside of government. It's her own, but it was seeded with this idea that we needed to do more with women. And right now, actually, I'm working with my co-partner, a woman named Sasha Havlicek, in London to create a worldwide initiative called Women and Extremism, really about these very concepts, because you are correct. The role of women has not been explored. The opportunities for us to do more to prevent and help inoculate using women is really, really powerful. And I think we need to stop looking at just the victim piece, which is very, very serious, and there is a lot there that we don't have to discuss at this moment, but also to understand in terms of the narratives that are being used to pull in women and to pull in young people. Women can play a very, very important role, and we need to do more.
Thank you.
Next question or comment.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Abbas Bazarga from Georgia State University.
Hi there. Thank you very much. Really enjoying this call. I have two quick questions to drill down a little bit further in the discussion. The first relates to a conversation we had with Scott Carpenter from Google Ideas a couple of months back, and that was between the distinction between counter and alternative narratives, the idea of countering a message directly as opposed to providing an outlet, so to speak, to kind of direct momentum in another direction. I'm wondering, in your office and in your experiences, whether that distinction really means anything, whether it's good to think in those terms, et cetera. And then perhaps as a segue to the second question, to drill deeper about who we're getting in the tent with and who our reliable local actors are, while you all were in conference at the summit 2 weeks ago, a colleague and I were able to publish an article in the Washington Post questioning whether or not the Muslim NGO sector could be leveraged as a strategic partner in CVE work. And in our work in Turkey, for example, we found that they are not only physical gatekeepers in the sense of the same routes that supply humanitarian aid could probably funnel foreign fighters, but they could also serve very easily as ideological gatekeepers. And I'm just wondering about the notion of these transnational Muslim NGOs, which are normally seen as problematic, being enlisted at this time for possible CVE work. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Really great question. So Scott's a dear friend and former colleague and super smart, and I'm glad you had a conversation with him about this. And Google Ideas has been doing really pioneering work. I don't need to tell you that, just for the purposes of others who may not know about what Google Ideas is doing in the space of countering violent extremism. Very early on, built out the first of its kind. They held a summit in Dublin in 2010 in which they understood the power of the voices and the stories and the narratives of former extremists. And so they pulled together a summit of former extremists of all kinds, former FARC, former IRA, former gang members, former Al-Qaeda, formers of all kinds, and survivors, and they had a summit in Dublin and created, by the way, the first and only network of its kind in the world of former extremists. It's called the Against Violent Extremism Network, AVE. The AVE network has been, Google started it, and it now has great support from a private sector group called the Gen Next Foundation and the Institute for Strategic Dialogue in London. It is a great platform from which we can hear real live stories and credible journeys from people who have actually walked the walk. It also allows us, obviously, to see the similarities in some of the recruitment and the reasons why people join these kinds of organizations. So I just wanted to say that in terms of the distinction on lexicon and what you counter and what you are able to, you know, I wasn't privy to the conversation, so I'm not really sure what the contours were of the conversation. But I will say, you know, the term CVE, it carries a lot of baggage for a lot of people. They're not really exactly sure what goes into countering violent extremism and countering it or dissecting it or undermining it, or, you know, we understand the basic concept here is to be able to put forward elements of external narratives that directly provoke a conversation among the kids who are being recruited so that they're seeing another side. We are diminishing the narrative of the extremists. We are debunking it. We are countering it. We are providing alternatives to it, all of the above. So I hope that answers that. I'm not exactly sure what conversation you had with Scott, but I think really being very precise in this, we want to be able to blast the marketplace with alternatives, not so that there are alternatives out there and that the loudest voices in where millennials are gathering information are not those of the extremists. With regard to your second question about reliable local actors, you know, this is a very important question. I talked earlier about the importance of grassroots and how that is really critical to this, and that each locale makes a difference, but you cannot just look at one big, you know, country and say, these are the voices that represent it, that you actually have to go community by community and really understand what makes a difference. Sometimes those credible actors are Muslim, what you called Muslim NGOs. Sometimes they're not. It really depends on that community. It is about the actors on the ground who are able to understand the infrastructure and the nuances of the particular youth that are in that space and are able to connect with them. We have not seen enough, by the way, effort and enough resources given to grassroots organizations to lift up their capacity to do more. That includes, NGOs that are so-called Muslim NGOs. Nor have we seen, by the way, the kind of money that could be placed into into civil society by Muslim philanthropists, and that has been a tremendously huge problem. The monies that go towards spearheading efforts either come from here in the United States, come from the big foundations, and not enough philanthropists who happen to be Muslim are putting their money into this effort. And I find that to be really problematic at times, because when you look at programs and kids want to know where the money comes from, they also want to know that it's a wide variety of funds that are coming to the table, and it comes from all faiths and all dimensions, and we're not seeing the kind of Muslim philanthropy in this space.
Thank you. Our next comes from Bikshuni Charlie from Claremont School of Theology.
Hi, thank you for taking my question, and thank you for running this dialogue and your work. And I had a couple of questions. It's a very brief, though. And my first one is what the United States' engagement in peacekeeping prospects are, and how to actually bring in a narrative and ideology of nonviolence and peacemaking, and how we can build rewards for narratives of nonviolence and peacemaking. And the related question is of the moral credibility and role of nonviolence in the prospects for U.S. engagement in peacekeeping. And then finally, I think I heard you mention before that some extremists aren't Buddhist or Hindu, and even though that's probably true in the Arab Arabian Peninsula, we do know from Myanmar there are rising Buddhist extremists, unfortunately, now. So this conversation does, I view it as extending larger. But thank you for taking my question.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. I want to be clear on the last point that you made. I didn't say that there were no extremists of other kinds. I was saying that ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, other groups like it, are not preying upon people. That's what I was getting. That was my point. Not that there weren't other kinds of extremists. I want to be clear about that. So I'm glad you asked that so that I could clarify.
Thank you.
On your other point about peace building and what the United States is doing around those issues. We do that kind of programming, both with youth and in the interfaith capacity. There are different offices at the State Department. I'm getting very bureaucratic here. But there are different offices at the State Department that do generally, I would put it into peace building. I don't think it's really called that exactly. I really don't think that that's the only terminology you can use, but sort of building effective resilient strategies around nonviolence. And I think, if you look at some of the efforts in the Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Bureau at the U.S. Department of State, you also look at some of the programs that have been done with exchange programs with the Educational and Cultural Affairs Bureau. And if you also look at some of the work that's being done in the Interfaith Office right now, you'll see elements of all of that.
Right. Yeah, it would be great to see if you could get Google Ideas and Gen Next and those people interested in helping work with religious partners in actually teaching the tools of nonviolent protest as a form of channeling anger and frustration and, you know, experiences of suffering into other modalities, because if people don't see those, even we can have a lot of ideology about against extremism, but we have to offer some other tactics for people to follow. I think without that, we're going to have trouble working. But I appreciate your efforts, and thanks for taking my question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jack Maline from Interfaith Alliance.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for doing this call. And
my pleasure.
I want to come from a slightly different perspective. Here at Interfaith Alliance, we were approached by a number of American Muslim groups who were concerned about the messaging, careful as it was, that still seemed to point a finger at the Muslim community and made them feel insecure. Now, I know that you and Hannah Rosenthal, when you were at the State Department, had this wonderful custom that you developed of each of you speaking on behalf of the other community so that people understood we were all in this together. And that's why I think we as an interfaith organization need to ask this question about how do we message about the dangers of extremism without marginalizing the Muslim community in America of Americans.
Yeah, you know, this is such an important question, and when you said Hannah, I had a huge smile on my face because she's such a special human being. She's done amazing work for our country, and it was such an honor. I learned so much from her. I think that it's been a very chaotic and rocky road since 9/11 with the conversation here in America, particularly faith communities trying to unpack, you know, what's happening in the world and how we talk about things. And I know that the American Muslim communities have had some really robust conversations around all these themes. It's really interesting to me because American Muslims are the most diverse group of Muslims anywhere in the world, and yet the kind of groups that we have are just, you know, they're only a few, actually, groups here in America, if you compare that to the kind of civil society groups that are faith-based groups in Europe, for example. I mean, we are hardly represented here in the United States. It's really, really interesting. And I think that the megaphone for a lot of the conversations have come out of one or two of these groups that claim to speak for everyone. And I think it's very, very dangerous because there's an advocacy component to it that becomes quite political as well. So it's been very hard to navigate through some of those, you know, some of those conversations. And it's really important that they have had many other faith groups have had a chance to speak to government officials about what they perceive as taking place. I will say that there are different dimensions to the conversation. I spoke right in the beginning of this call about the history of America and who we are as Americans and how our presidents have talked about the religion of Islam. And I feel so proud to be able to tell you that we are still, I mean, our presidents have been consistent, and it is amazing. I mean, one of the first things I did as special representative to Muslim communities was to work with a woman named Precious Muhammad, who helped create the first of its kind timeline on American president, Islam, and diplomacy, because I wanted to know facts for myself. I wanted to understand from our founding fathers up until today how has our country talked about the issue of Islam and Muslims. And I learned a lot from that. That timeline, by the way, is now with the Smithsonian because nobody had put together that kind of information before. And I say this only because I think that I believe that we all understand, the vast majority, even though there are shrill voices in our country, the vast majority of Americans understand who we are as Americans and the importance of giving dignity to all voices, and that all religions are welcome in our nation, and this is who we are about. I think that the vast majority of Americans are there. It's important to point out when things become a little bit too strident, but I don't think that the only conversation that's happening with American Muslims is only around the potential threat that they might might be to our nation. I actually don't think that that's true. I think I have a very different context in terms of that conversation. And I'll tell you the one thing. I'm looking at the time. I realize that we only have a minute left. But I think that I worry that the more we have a conversation about how American Muslims are victims, it provides a very different frame and a very different context to what is actually the case here in America and who we are as Americans and what the evidence of our journey, as American Muslims has been, and the very different components to it, including the fact, by the way, as you well know, and I'm just saying this for the benefit of just sort of historic context, Islam came to this country at the time of the slaves, and it's a very interesting journey along our history in America to understand that, and it's not. I think it is important that when we talk about where we are right now, that we call things out. But I get very nervous about making it about we are victims and everything is about sort of the frame of terrorism. I don't believe that that is the case here in the United States. I don't think that that. I think there is a growing framework that a lot of people are trying to push forward that is pushing that out there. And I talk to a lot of Muslims who are very tired of that conversation because they feel like we've already gotten past who we are, some of these points. So it's a complex issue and it's very emotional, which is why it's so hard to sort of, to talk about. But I'm glad you raised the question and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah, thank you very much for this hour of conversation. I think we really learned from your insights and your experience in the State Department. And to everybody for your terrific questions, I apologize that we couldn't get to those who had queued up, but we are out of time. And we will, of course, be coming back to this topic. And I encourage you to follow Farah on Twitter. It's at Farah_PANDITH. So you can continue to follow her work there. And we look forward to seeing the fruits of your efforts, Farah.
Thank you so very much, and I hope everybody has a nice afternoon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.